So we have finished almost everything, just a few slides in the end. I remember I was going very, very fast there. So just coming back to those slides, for some reason it's not presenting. It is. Very good. Taking forever, but hopefully it will get there. It must be Edurom, because it never happens at my home, and it doesn't happen in some rooms where there is good signal. Probably there is a very weak signal in this room, and the computer, for some reason, is trying and trying and trying. Okay. I'm seeing the same thing on my screen. It's really a shame, because this is a computer science department, can you believe it? And I can't work with this. I'll start PowerPoint in this computer then. Go to the science. Working on science. Maybe this will work. I think this should work. Okay. That's it.
Show up.
It is. Very good. So what I will do is I will just very quickly rush through the slides. If you remember, we were talking about how science works. And what I told you about is, first we watched the movie on Buckminster Fullerenes, and then I prompted you to look at some of the things that were in the movie. And some of the things were finding research area, where they got the funding from, publishing. The world is small. Many foreigners, as you saw, contacting with each other, working with each other. Networking, very important. Structure of the labs, where you saw young people, postdocs or research assistants, doctoral students, helping with the lab, doing the dirty work. Scientists in U.S., majority is foreign-born, nothing unusual. Typical working places for scientists, and then social character of science, whether you should get the money, tenure, defend your PhD, publish a paper, is decided by other people. I dare to say that there are fewer dishonest people in science than elsewhere, although they happen also like anywhere else. Then scientific publications, if you remember, there is a whole hierarchy of what they are worth. In Poland, there is a system of points from the ministry. Typically, the points, I think they are strongly correlated with the quality of publication, although there are all kinds of turbulences, so you cannot fully trust it. And also, some journals are so good that even if they give 500 points, that's probably not enough. And some other places that you get 20 points are probably not worth 20 points. So it's correlated, but it's not perfect. Then the next thing is grants. People get money. We are not going to talk about writing grant proposals. We will talk about writing papers. Writing proposals is somewhat different, but very similar. In many ways, it's similar. Funding agencies, in every country, there are funding agencies, and they also are, they give different amounts of money, but they also have different prestige. It is prestigious to get money from those agencies because they have very strict peer review process. So when you get money from them, it means that some other scientists, probably prominent in their field, looked at your proposal. Peer review, I mentioned that. We talked about this in detail. If you haven't done it yet, you will be doing it quite soon. The moment you start publishing, people will start sending you papers to review. And I think I stopped somewhere here. This is an important idea. People expect from you few but outstanding contributions. If you have just a few papers, maybe you will not get enough points to get a permanent position in the university, but you will be very well known in the world. Much better known than when you publish 100 papers, 20 points each. 20 points, by the way, it's, I think, the lowest I've seen on the ministerial list publications. So few outstanding contributions, and then aim at them. Of course, maybe you will publish a few other kind of lesser quality papers to get your points, to get your position, but remember to aim high and do really great things. Of course, it's very social. So people expect from you honesty, integrity, reliability. Answer emails quickly, help other people when building network. You will be liked, people will think well about you, they will make it easier for you to develop your career. Some personality traits are also important. Whether it's good or bad, people will also judge your contributions based on how they respect you as a scientist, how they like you. So it's a good idea to be likable. Be nice to other people. Then you will not need to store all the knowledge in your head, because you can phone somebody and ask. You can meet somebody for lunch, you can ask them. You will learn things much quicker. This is from a textbook on research design. It's a good idea to be nice, because then you don't need to be afraid that somebody pisses in your cultures when you are not in the lab, does something bad to you. So these are kind of the personal character of science. It's a good idea to be not too difficult to other people. There is actually an anecdote. I'll start another presentation where I'll tell you the anecdote. I was once attending a retreat. Retreat in Polish, retreat has many more meanings, but the meaning I'm using it for is recollection. And there was a monk, Franciscan monk, who said that when he was entering the monastery, he had a conversation with the abbot, with the main monk in the monastery, and the monk told him, of course, this is a Christian monastery, so you have to love your brothers. You should love your brothers. That's a good Christian behavior. And a personal advice from me, why is it not starting? I don't know. Okay, here it is. Personal advice from me, don't make it too difficult for other monks, for the brothers. Why is it not visible? Today we have all kinds of... nothing. I swear, I don't see that on my screen. And I just was presenting correctly, wasn't I? It's one of those days that everything goes wrong. Oh, here it is. So my personal advice, don't make it too difficult for other monks to like you. To like you. To love you, actually. You know, Christian love. So it's a good idea to not to be too difficult of a person. To generally be nice to other people. It makes life easier. You don't have to work that hard against other people. The topic for today, that I have chosen is how to identify a good research question. Of course, like many things in this seminar, this is a personal view, but of course a personal view based on years of observation and experience. So you will get another personal view from your advisor and from other advisors, from your mentors. You should definitely learn what they think about it. But this is something I came across when I was a first-year doctoral student. There was a lecture in the computer science department at Carnegie Mellon of Herb Simon, a very famous person. You see some of his pictures in this talk. The topic of the lecture in the first month of the studies, they called it immigration course for new students. He had a lecture on the topic of finding research problems, research questions. I liked it so much that I attended it probably, I don't know, 3-4 more times every year that he gave it. Very impressive way of looking at it, and I'm going to share it with you. I really like it, and I do believe that it's valuable. That's why I'm sharing it with you. So, finding a research question, this is one of those important skills. You really have to learn it, all of these things. You have to master them in order to be a complete scientist, because you have to do these things. So, identifying questions is critical for your success, absolutely, because if the questions are very good, you'll get people's attention. People will start reading your work. They will be interested. So it's really critical. Typically in the beginning, you don't have that many tools, that many ideas for how to find a good research question. So you'll have to rely on your advisor, on your mentor, who will help you. For example, when you enter this doctoral program, you already picked an area, a topic that your advisor proposed. That happened with probably every one of you, unless you had contact with your advisors before entering the program and you created that topic together. That happens also. But later, when you are done with your studies, when you are independent, start working on your own, you'll have to come up with questions for research. And it's a very important skill that really makes a distinction between a very good scientist and an average scientist. What are the characteristics of an ideal research question? The ideal research question, and many of these slides actually are from Simon. I kind of adopted them. Maybe I wrote them myself, but the ideas were precisely what he was saying. It should build on your personal preferences. So things like, do you like working individually or in a team? If you like working in a team, you may be part of a bigger project where everybody has a little bit of a piece of work, and that piece of work becomes a dissertation. But if you like working individually, you don't like other people, which is a big handicap, by the way, then you should pick something that allows you to be independent from other people. What kind of work do you like most? Theory, implementation, experimentation? That's another question that you need to ask yourself. Nobody will help you with that. You answer that question. It should build on your technical strengths. Why? Because that will make it faster for you. You don't need to learn those things. You should pick topics that are already in areas that you already know. Then you're already done. You are ready to do the research. You don't need to first explore an area and learn it. So technical strengths, that is something that should give you direction for where to look for problems. It should also match your plans for after obtaining your PhD. So if you want to have a startup, think about some interesting industrial processes that you can study during your doctoral studies. If you want to teach, be in a university, that makes you maybe pick topics that are more theoretical, can be more abstract, you can afford that. But most important of all, the topic should be such that when you wake up in the morning, you see these days it's before 6 o'clock, it's already light, you see it's light, then you get up from your bed, quickly take shower, get on your bicycle and come to work because the work is waiting for you. So what this wants to say is that you need to pick topics that are really exciting, that excite you. If you are working on something that bores you, that you don't see the need for it, either learn the need, either understand the topic well so that it excites you, or think about changing a topic. Changing a topic in this program is very difficult, I know. I find it too difficult, but I know that it's difficult. It happens, but it's hard to change an advisor in this program. So that's something that in the long run should actually change. It should be easier to change topics. Because sometimes you may not know exactly what you want when you enter the program, and then a topic can clarify, requires you to change the original framing. Anyway, excitement, very important. In humanity, in the history of humanity, the discovery processes took multiple paths. But as you know, the saying, all roads lead to Rome, it's also in Polish, wszystkie drogi prowadzą do Rzymu. That's when Rome was the main place in the world. They were building roads that were going to Rome. There are many ways of getting something and done, and many people did different things. There's another saying in English, there's more than one way to skin a cat. It's a little bit more macabre, but they say that also. So it is a hard problem. There are many ways of finding problems, but there are some heuristics that are useful, and these are the heuristics. The heuristics are what I'm going to talk about. So, as I told you, I learned that from this guy. He usually called a research problem a research question. Question like, you know, what happens if I do something? How can I improve the quality of concrete? Yes, or things like that that are familiar to you. And the question does not necessarily need to be very specific. It can be general in the beginning, but it is usually a question. And then once you have a question, a candidate, you should subject it to four basic tests. The first test, first question. So when you have a candidate, you should ask those four questions, testing that problem. Is this question solvable within the given amount of time? For you, it's 4 years. Three and a half. Can I solve this problem? Can I answer this question in the 3.5 years? If I cannot, then not a good question for you. Because you don't want to be 3 years from now in a situation where you don't know how to start, how to bite that question. So you have to pick a question that is doable. Of course, it's very difficult for you to judge because most of you are just starting in your area. But trust your advisor here. The advisor formulated the question, and you have to trust that this is solvable. Typically, you can trust them because they've been in the area for a while. So can I finish it in that 3 to 4 years? Of course, when you work on papers, can I solve this question in a year? Maybe there's a bigger question, direction, whole line of research, but the concrete question for a paper, for a publication is, can I solve it in a year? Because otherwise, you're not going to be very productive if you cannot solve it. The second question, will anybody care about the answer? This is a question about utility. Some people think that scientists are doing things just to play around. In Polish, there's this nice saying, sobie amuzom. That's not right, that's not correct. Actually, people are looking at scientists to provide answers to important questions that are important for the society. And if you are looking at an important question, you will get the attention of other scientists and other people. So I think it is an important question. Will anybody care about the answer? There is a question that you may ask these days easier. Will at least two people download my article when I'm done? Will at least a couple of people read my dissertation? So will there be interest? And the more interest, the better for you. So Simon used to give the following example. Here's a question. How many light bulbs are there in this room? Can I solve this question in 4 years? Sure, I can solve it in 5 minutes. So it's solvable. But will anybody care about this? Probably none of you. Maybe the building manager will care how many bulbs there are, right? But maybe an electrician, but not us. It's not a very good question in that respect. Sometimes the utility is not very clear. For example, the structure of DNA or the structure of the universe has very little impact on us, but it's still a very, very interesting question. There is a journal that is meant to be a joke, a Journal of Improbable Research. You can go there to that website, and they also give, every year they give a reward, IG Nobel Prize, they call it. Unfortunately, the internet is not very strong here, so I cannot do it. But if you look at it, you will see that they pick absurd topics. I remember there was there were topics like sounds emitted by whales during copulation, during lovemaking. Okay, who will care about this? It does not interest me too much, right? Questions like this. So really, very funny. They really pick funny topics of papers, real papers published somewhere, and they mention it in their journal, and they also give the award for the most absurd, least interesting topic. The third test is as important as the first two. Will I be the first to answer the question? In science, only the first person gets the reward, gets the publication, gets a prize. We sometimes say he rediscovered the wheel. What we mean by that, well, he is a smart fellow. He made a great discovery. Unfortunately, that discovery has been made already a while ago. So will you be the first? Sometimes there is competition. There are other people working on the problem. So what makes you think that you are going to be first? And you want to be first. Questions that may help here is this the right time to work on this problem? Does the state of science make it possible? If you look at the history of science, when, for example, microscope was developed, suddenly there was a lot of research on bacteria, on cells, because people had the tool to actually look at those microscopic things. I once watched a lecture on a series of lectures on the history of calculus in mathematics. It was interesting that some of the first questions appeared in antiquities. Some of the paradoxes and thoughts about calculus. But real race, a lot of progress happened in, I think, 17th, 18th century, when there were fundamental mathematical contributions made. Suddenly it became a race. Suddenly the science became ripe for that. So is this the right time? Does the present state of science makes the research feasible? Another question is, of course, are other people working on it now? If there are, then we are dealing with a race. What makes me think that I will be the first? Others are also trying. And here, the fourth question is, do I have good tools to address this question? Good tools that make me more likely to solve the question and be the first. This is a step a little bit to the side. What makes you think that you will be successful? Many people answer very boldly, a little bit arrogantly, because I'm smarter than others. That's a very bad answer, in fact, because there are many, many smart people, and I'm willing to make a bet that each one of you in this room has intelligence that is well above what you need. You have enough, and all of you are smart. And there are many other places in Poland and outside in the world where there are a lot of smart people. So that's not a very good answer, because there are many, many, many smart people. Some people answer, here's a joke that I heard from Randy Pausch years ago in a breakfast for Carnegie Mellon alumni. you say that you are in 99th IQ percentile. You know, they have that. They tell you that you have IQ of 140, and that can be translated to into a percentile. So how many people, what percentage of people are smarter than you or less smart? So when you say I'm in 99th IQ percentile, it means that there's only 1% of people in the world that are smarter than you. But 1%, that's an old number, of course. That means that there are only 55 million people that are smarter than you. But 55 million, that's a huge competition, isn't it? So not a very good answer, I'm smarter. A much better answer is because I work hard. That's a better answer. As I said, all of you have well above the minimum. So now, those of you who work harder will be more successful. It's not a great answer, though, because everybody who wants to succeed works hard. Everybody, in every discipline. If you look at sports people, they are training every day to develop. A few years ago, I heard on the radio an interview with Justyna Kowalczyk, who is, as you know, cross-country skier. Her day looked like, you know, I wake up at 7, you know, breakfast, shower, whatever, then I go exercise until 2 p.m., then I take a break, and then I exercise again. And that's like 6 days a week. Really, really hard work. And everybody who wants to succeed works hard. Better answer, but not the best. Secret weapon, that's a concept that Simon was using in his lectures. I'm going to succeed because I have a secret weapon. You know the concept of secret weapon. Hitler wanted to develop a Wunderwaffe, which is a miraculous weapon. If you have a miraculous weapon, you can defeat your enemies. Yes? Luckily, he didn't succeed. Secret weapon is, what is it? What is secret weapon? Secret weapon is a comparative, maybe unfair, advantage over your competitors. I mentioned to you that the world is not necessarily fair. I'm just 176. Even if I loved playing basketball, I probably wouldn't be very good at it because I'm too short. That's bad, really. You know, unfair. I'm not small enough to be a horse rider. I'm too heavy and too big for a horse rider. That's bad, too. And my eyes are not as good, so I cannot be a sharpshooter anymore, right? And things like that. So the world is generally not fair. So this sounds like it's a little unfair, the weapon. But if it gives you an advantage, you should absolutely use it. So what could be a secret weapon? A secret weapon could be a problem that nobody has thought about before. People were looking at it, but nobody was in a situation when they really sat down and thought about this. Maybe you are the first to think about this problem because of personal experiences. I'll show some examples. Advice also from Simon, don't look for research ideas in journal articles. Why not? If you look at the journal article, first of all, the person who wrote, or the team that wrote the article, started working on it probably a couple of years ago. They worked on it, they found a solution, and they identified unsolved problems that they want to go on next. And then it took them several months to publish that paper, unless they published in those predatory journals that have very, very quick turnaround. You know, they publish your work in a month or two. Typically, very good journals have a much longer cycle. So it's not unusual that it takes a year before the paper is published. So they worked, they had ideas, they wrote it, sent it to the reviewers a year ago. And then it took a year. Themselves are already probably more advanced than they were a year ago when they wrote the paper. Furthermore, the paper is read by many people. When it shows in the library, some people have the habit of going and reading and browsing and looking for ideas. If you look for ideas there, you are going to be already 1-2 years behind other people. And other people may have the same idea as you because they read the paper too. So not a very good source of ideas. Personal experiences. Alexander Fleming was a brilliant fellow. Of course, you need to be brilliant, but you are all. Also hardworking, but the problem he had, everybody has a problem, of course, at least one, maybe more, he was dirty, very, very dirty, untidy. So in 1928, when he was going on vacation, he left a lot of dishes with all kinds of cultures in the sink, saying, well, when I come back, I'll wash it, right? I don't want to wash it now. When he came back, he noticed that, of course, it was all moving, you know, there were all kinds of living things in those dishes. And he was very curious, so he started looking at them, and he noticed that there were generally a lot of bacteria, but the places that had fungi, I think, maybe it depends on British or American pronunciation, grzyby, pleśnie, there were no bacteria. And that was puzzling. Why there are no bacteria there? And he thought maybe there is something in those fungi that kills bacteria. He started examining it, extracting from fungi, and that's how he discovered antibiotics, penicillin, in fact. Very successful. I don't know if you can read it. Penicillin cures gonorrhea, rzeżączka, in 4 hours. Wow, that's a very practical problem, isn't it? People, a disease that was incurable suddenly can be cured. And many other diseases, such popular diseases as lung infection, deadly, he could cure it. And then he got Nobel Prize, knighthood from the king, and it's one of the most influential discoveries in the history of science. It was just an accident. How many people leave the dishes in the sink? How many people look at them later? An accident. Good place to look for problems. Since Fleming already beat you to it with penicillin, I take it we can dispose of your week old sandwich. Another idea, that was not a real experiment, but Benjamin Franklin was a very curious fellow, and in the 18th century there was a discussion about the nature of atmospheric lightning, yes? Some people believe that it's electricity, others disagreed with that. He proposed an experiment that was hopefully never conducted, of putting a kite on a wire around the time that there is a storm. If it's electricity, it will go through the wire down. Luckily, it was probably never conducted because, of course, it would electrocute everybody down here. How did he get an idea? Essentially, as a child, he was flying kites with his father. So it built on his personal experiences. He thought, wow, that's an interesting thing. We can put a wire between the clouds and the earth and then check if it's electricity. Simon himself is an interesting case. When he was still an undergraduate student, he took an internship at a local government, and he was doing some things, you know, a young fellow student. And he was always very curious, very interested. He noticed that in theory, in economics, there is a fundamental assumption that people maximize their utility. Utility is a concept of, you can maybe find some synonyms, not exactly reflecting it, but it's benefit, gain. People are looking after themselves. When they make choices, they try to maximize their satisfaction. Another fundamental assumption in economics is that firms maximize their profits. So if you have a firm, a company, you try to maximize your profits. So That's an underlying fundamental assumption in the in economics. And he noticed that in the government where he was working, people were not maximizing the benefit of the society themselves or, you know, the government. And he came up with an idea that people don't maximize, they don't optimize, they satisfy. He invented that term. What is satisficing? Satisficing is essentially picking the first alternative that looks reasonable, that looks good. If you want to kind of think about this, his way of thinking, think about an important decision such as choosing your husband or your wife. Suppose, I'm married, but suppose I was looking for a wife and I was 20, let's say, 20 something. What would I have to do if I followed the assumption in economics? Well, there are 8 billion people in the world. Half of that are women. 4 billion. Of the 4 billion, there are many children, many elderly women, and many of them are married already. But I suspect there is, at any given point in time, there is probably 200 million, 300 million, I'm just estimating it, of women who are close to me in my age and unmarried yet. If I wanted to maximize my satisfaction in several ways, like, you know, I want a woman who is very smart, very intelligent. She's pretty. She has good heart. She dresses nicely. She can they say about cooking. Getting something. So if I wanted to maximize those 5 or 10 attributes, what would I have to do? I'd have to examine that 300 million women, get to know each one of them, see how, you know, how they are, how smart they are, how they have good heart or not, etc. If I did that, I'm 67 now, I would be still probably busy with the first several hundred, right? Otherwise, I wouldn't get to know them well. So how can I possibly maximize? How can I optimize? I cannot do it. I don't have the computational power to do that. That's the idea underlying this. We don't have, essentially, the ability, the computational power to maximize. So we satisfy. So, you know, you meet a woman for whom your heart is starting to pound. Well, you get to know her a little closer, and think, oh, wow, that's nice. Nice wife, yes. Those of you who are married already probably recognize that you are not examining the whole population of the world, but you just picked a good partner who was reasonably good. Once he saw a computer, he thought, wow, but that's amazing, because people also, in a way, are computers. So I can use a computer to simulate people, to actually model people's behavior. In fact, he conceived a hypothesis that he called physical symbol system hypothesis. He said computers, humans, and animals also, I mean the higher developed, have one thing in common, at least one thing in common. They need to have some hardware, some computing machine that they use to process information. So humans and computers process symbols. We see things, we process them. The physical symbol system hypothesis. So when you have a computer, you can actually simulate humans. When he discovered that, he was actually one of the... There were two camps in the world that created artificial intelligence. He and later his doctoral student, Alan Newell, created one of the approaches to artificial intelligence based on modeling humans by means of production rules. So then, you know, he moved through four different areas, and in every one of them, he is very well known. A theory of organization, his books are still read and cited and referred to. Economics, that was the contribution with the foundations of economics, the not maximizing but satisfying. He got Nobel Prize. Artificial intelligence, he got Turing Award. That's the highest award in the area of artificial intelligence. Von Neumann Theory Prize, computer theory. In psychology, he was also well known because of his effort of modeling people. So one small thing that puzzled him, that he thought there's something in it, he just followed, and successes he achieved, it was because of that. He was the one who said, don't look for ideas in newspapers, in magazines, scientific magazines. The way he worked is he made it as a point to have lunch once a week with somebody at the university who worked in a different area than him. He was in a psychology department, partly also in computer science, and also interested in other things. So he would call, I'd like to have lunch with you. Who would refuse to one of the best known people in the university? Because of the Nobel Prize, he became very well known, right? So they said, of course, I'm honored, I'm delighted to have lunch with you. He would go to lunch, and he would often ask questions let's say it's a chemist, chemical engineer, chemist. He would ask, what is happening in chemistry these days? What is the exciting thing? And in every branch of science, there is something going on, typically at that time. So then he would talk about it. He would ask out, and then he would think: is there anything I can say here? Is there anything that I, with my experience and education in other fields, can I say something useful here? If he could, he would go after lunch. He would maybe even pay for the lunch, and he would send an email to the guy. Can you send me some references or papers that I should read to learn more about this idea? He would read those papers, then he would kind of crystallize his ideas, and then he would go to the library for a week. I mean, of course, he went out home, but he would spend a week in the library reading journals in a very directed way, looking for things that were directly relevant to his ideas and the problems that people were discussing. So this is how he read papers. Of course he read papers, but he didn't read papers when they appeared, which he advised against, but he, if he had an idea, he would start reading. You have to do it to find out if you are going to be the first. So maybe his ideas were already published, he would find it out in that week. Another example is something that I found when I was, I thought back at it. When I was a high school student in Lublin, I went to Sigma Xi lectures. It's a scientific society, very interesting, popular lectures. I've been always very curious. So there was a lecture by a physicist, Bogdan Adamczyk. When I recalled it and tried to find him, I discovered that he was already deceased, so unfortunately he's not there anymore. But he had a lecture on ecotherapy. Very interesting. He was a physicist, and as a child he visited his grandparents in the village, and there was a well, as you know, these are typical Polish wells, they may be deep, and he noticed that when he spoke to the well, he wasn't stuttering. Stuttering, jąkać się. To stutter is jąkać się. So that helped him in speaking more clearly without stuttering. And that question always puzzled him. So when he became a physicist, he went into acoustics and wanted to find out what is going on. So it's physics, acoustics, but it's at the border with medicine. And by the way, you remember that already, maybe you were not yet a scientist at that time. Just a few years ago, there was a reform of the higher education in Poland by Gowin. And of course, no reform, no law, no activity is all bad or all good. But one terrible thing that Govind did, really terrible, is to put boundaries between disciplines. So said, okay, you are a computer scientist, you have to publish in computer science journals. You are a civil engineer, you have to publish in civil engineering journals. That's a terribly, terribly destructive idea for science. Why is it destructive? Because computer science, for example, did not exist until 1970s, maybe 1980s. My advisor in computer science in the Netherlands, where I finished my studies, was a chemist by training. He became a computer scientist because he got interested. He kind of drifted, changed his field. Good research is good research. And the most fertile areas of research are exactly at the connection of two tectonic plates, which are the fields. Because it's difficult, because these people know this field, these people know this field. In between, this is where the interesting things are happening. So interdisciplinary work, talking to other people in different fields, is very, very fruitful. Look at this guy. He was able to marry his research in physics with medicine, and he invented a therapy for stuttering in medicine, of course, that he called echotherapy, essentially providing patients with their own voice with a delay, exactly what echo does. He was so successful that at that time, this was 1970s in Poland, communist Poland, he convinced the local governments to build devices that you could call. You took a telephone, called the device, and the device would give you your voice with a delay. And that was a therapeutic device. Today, of course, it would be much easier. You could have a device that size that you could put in your ear, right? You could do a lot of things like that. But at that time, the technology wasn't as developed. So there were phone numbers in most major cities in Poland that you could call and talk to them, get your voice with a delay. Here is him. I found it later, of course, doing experiments with kids that had problems with stuttering. Again, look, just a single thing. How many people were physicists working in acoustics who were stuttering and then talking to the world? Not too many, I think. Worlds in different countries look differently, by the way. Not necessarily the way that it looks here. A secret weapon can be also special instruments, tools, or piece of knowledge that other people don't have. So it's a good idea to look around you and to see what is it that is very, very strong here around you. Look at the strengths of your department, your mentor, your advisor, and I don't know all the departments, but I've seen, for example, mechanical engineering, often in the context of the Martian vehicles, the Mars vehicles. Boy, this is they are very good at it. They've been winning those competitions. That's a strength of the group. Probably not all of the things are published and widely known. Maybe the theory is published, but there are a lot of practical things that they know how to do, clearly. So that's a strength of the place. Look at the strongest things around you, if there are any tools that they have. Newton was a genius, of course. He did a lot of incredible things. But some people accuse him that he wasn't very very fair, because he developed calculus, so the integrals, differentials, he understood them, he developed a mechanism, a tool. He would not publish it, but he used it to solve many problems. He solved many problems in physics and published papers on those problems without actually revealing the tool, how the tool has led him to solve that problem. Only when Leibniz started publishing his version of calculus, again, this was a good time, many people tried. When Leibniz started to publish, Newton, apparently he thought, well, I should publish my version, which was better, by the way, than Leibniz. So he had a powerful theoretical tool that he used. A little unfair, but Sometimes, you know, why are there many Nobel Prizes in Caltech or CERN in Switzerland? They have the most powerful accelerator. If you want to do work in theoretical physics, physics of particles, go there. The scientists there have a big advantage over you. If you want to do theoretical physics here, okay, good luck. You can do a lot of things, but it's going to be hard. Unless, of course, you go there for an internship or postdoc or something. Software tools in my group at the university, we developed our own software. We shared the software in compiled version, but we never gave the sources. That gave us an advantage because every student who wanted to do something in that area had to learn a little bit. That was the disadvantage, learn a little bit of the software, produce high-quality software because we wanted to add it to the program so that it's reliable. But on the other hand, the student had a lot of insight from the code, and he could get much quicker to do useful things because the software was there already. He didn't have to program from the beginning. So things that you have around you, special instruments, tools. Okay, special instruments, I already mentioned Newton. He had this secret weapon. That's, they say that's actually not true about him being hit by an apple, and that led him to discovering gravity. There is a beautiful quote from Newton that that I will come back to when we talk about writing. It is really a beautiful quote that that you should remember. He wrote, "If I have seen further, it is by standing on the shoulders of giants. So if I was more successful than other scientists, it's because I was building on very good, great work of other people before me." That's what he essentially said. I'll talk about this, I'll mention it again in the context of acknowledgements. It's good to be generous in acknowledgements in your publications. Sometimes it can be a training in a discipline that other people are not trained in. Example, we have in our department Dr. Jacek Grekov. He's a musician, active, playing Balkan music. He understands music. He teaches even courses on music, very good courses. I've never taken one, but my wife did. I don't know what exactly his research area is, but I suspect it's not very far from music. There was a faculty at Carnegie Mellon doing artificial intelligence in computer science department. He was a musician too, and he was working on computer generation of music. So things that we can do now with the large language models, we have a large language model can read a lot of music and then can compose. Right? He was doing things like that almost 40 years ago. If you studied biology, art, architecture, change your interests, that is where you can look for ideas, because for a computer scientist who has to learn music and then do research on music, as a musician you have big advantage. You already know it, you like it, you love it, you can do much better work. Sometimes it may be personal experiences, cancer, Alzheimer's disease in the family, that bring ideas. How can you combine it with your discipline? Art, biology, architecture. An advice that is related to finding topics is, there is a saying in English, don't put all your eggs in one basket. The idea is that, of course, if you fall, you break the eggs, all of them. So invest in different places. Let's use probably in investments a lot. When you invest in several places. If one fails, the others are still going to do well. It's probably a good idea to have a handful of questions. Let's say, have many questions, but always work on the top three. Top three in terms of the promise, what you can, how fast you can solve them, what you can do with them. For doctoral dissertation, of course, that's maybe a little too distracting. You should really focus on one, trusting that the choice of the question was good, the choice by your advisor. Chance prefers a prepared mind. That's another saying in English. Chance prefers a prepared mind. I like this quote from Mark Twain. He said many, many funny things. This one is, the man who does not read has no advantage over a man who cannot read. Right? What this tells me is, use the things that you are the best at. What are humans very good at? The brain. We don't have big nails, we don't have big teeth. Still, tigers usually run away from us because we have guns and other things, right? We still, because of our brain, we can do things. Thinking, the brain is powerful. Being prepared, being curious, so made Fleming look at the dishes, and to be prepared, we may talk this semester about creativity. That's an interesting topic, and it's a good idea to be creative. It turns out that creativity can be enhanced by experiences that you've had, that you have accumulated. It turns out that our brain is practically infinite. Practically. Of course, in theory, there's a finite number of cells, neurons, and synapses. But practically, it's infinite because you will never exceed the capacity of the brain. So you should learn as much as you can in all kinds of disciplines, never worrying about that it's too much. I said many stupid things in my life, but one of the most stupid was when I was in high school still, and I was saying things like, well, history or biology, I'm going to become an engineer anyway. I'm going to study at a technical university. Why would I need history or biology or chemistry? That was really stupid because you never know. These days, I use a lot of my knowledge of history. I really love even to hear about it. Chemistry, I used it. Even many of the examples I use in my teaching are from psychoanalysis, Freud. Amazingly, you know, the knowledge that you accumulate can be useful, and you never know when it is going to be useful. So learn as much as you can. It's an advice. Dissertation problem. Of course, most of you have already dissertation problems. Although you have dissertation areas, you can still change a little bit your questions. As you know, you have an area you've chosen. Changing the area in our university is not easy. I've seen that happen. It's really painful, loss of time, and sometimes they require you to start your studies again. Really a ridiculous idea. I think it's really destructive, not a very good idea. But you can still change within your area. You can adjust and go where you want. So one advice that I would like to give you, I try not to give this advice to my students because it's a little bold. Listen to me. I try not to say that. But because most of you, except for one person, you are not my students, I'm not giving it to you, Kasper, just to the others. Listen to your advisor. It's really a good advice. Listen to your advisor. Whenever I didn't listen to my advisor, because I was obstinate, I ended up wasting a lot of time. And, you know, after many months, I had to admit that the advisor was right. Of course, you can be right. I'm not saying that you are always wrong. But because the advisor has much more experience than you, the odds are against you. So typically listen to your advisor, that will save you time. And then there's not a problem here about funding. Funding is not certain, like here, that you get funding for 4 years. In US, the funding can be cut off. If the advisor has no money, sorry, you have no money also. You have no money, then you would have to pay the tuition fee and leave, so stipend for yourself. Tuition at Carnegie Mellon today is probably around $100,000 a year. Can you study like with that money? You have to be very wealthy to do that. But if you are, of course, you get the position of an assistant like you do, then you get the money, but the advisor has to have a grant. What are the strengths of this group, department, school, university, city? Because you need people to rely on. They are also secret weapons. Another thing is that a doctoral dissertation is just a progress report. It means that what this says is that you will never solve all the problems. You will not solve everything. So essentially, at some point, you answer some questions. You have to wrap it up, add a chapter, further work, future work, and publish it. You will never, very rarely, you will solve the problem to the end, that nobody can actually follow it up. There are probably examples of people who did that. I can think of John Nash. If you saw the movie Beautiful Mind, I think his piece of work, the Nash Equilibrium, is probably kind of rounded. You know, there is not much you can add. You can find another equilibrium, but his work is probably rounded. But it's an exception rather than a rule. So remember that somebody has to say, I'm done, and of course the advisor will help you with saying that. It's a good idea to play actively with the knowledge that you are gaining. Lay links between facts, be critical and ask questions. It turns out, and that these ideas are in psychology of memory. Some people, as you know, can remember things faster and longer than other people. And there are tricks to that. You can even, any one of you can learn to stand next to a railroad, watch the numbers on the train cars, and be able to reproduce them. It sounds impossible, but you can do it. It's a matter of training. And an important thing in that memory, remembering, is links between things. So the more links you lay in your memory, the easier you can retrieve information. So whenever you learn something, always ask yourself, do I believe it or not? If I believe it, how does this relate to another thing I know? Yes? If you cannot unite those two, then that's maybe an opportunity. Maybe what you just learned is wrong, or maybe what you learned in the past is wrong. And if both of the things were said by scientists, then you have an opportunity to correct them. So always play with knowledge. That's advice that comes from psychology. Always good idea. Take a real problem. So scientists not necessarily work on abstract, useless problems. I would say that real problems that occur in the society, in the world, are very good sources of inspiration. Things that people find useful, things that make can help the world. Best ideas come from real problems. Another thing is people are saying many things. I bet if I ask you about things, you would have different opinions. And when you listen to people will have different opinions. Absolutely. Well, look at the political discourse in Poland, right? People, as if they were sucking the milk from different mothers, right? Completely incompatible things, and they cannot even talk with each other. The same happens, of course, in any discipline, also in science. People will say different things. Sometimes they are wise, sometimes they are stupid. So you have to be careful who you are listening to. Always try to reconcile. Think yourself, do you believe what they are saying or not? What are the facts? How do they know it? Etc. So be careful who you are listening to, because you get a lot of advice, and 80% of that advice is ridiculous. So be careful. You have to think, because this is what we do best as humans. I mentioned that we don't have nails and teeth, but we still are doing well. This is what we do best. Another thing is that is good is test market your ideas. You have an idea, you tell it to your spouse, your wife, husband, boyfriend, girlfriend, to your parents, to your grandmother that you talk to, an idea that you have, and see what they think about this. Sometimes those very simple, naive questions that they will ask you will direct you in the right direction. There's a very good book that I absolutely recommend to you, young scientists, written for Richard Feynman. Surely you are joking, Mr. Feynman. And there's another book, What Do You Care What Other People Think? It was written for Feynman. He didn't write it himself. It was just, you know, a writer who was interviewing him and wrote it. The subtitle is Adventures of a Curious Character. There are many things there that are really interesting gems. One thing that I just recalled is the way he writes about teaching. He says that he couldn't live without teaching. And he gives the reasons. He gives two reasons why he wants to teach always. The first reason is that he writes, as a scientist, you have sometimes periods of time where you feel like flying, you know. You have a lot of inspiring ideas. You solve them. You publish them. You feel so good about yourself. And then there are longer periods of time when you don't have an idea. You are struggling and you feel useless. And at that time, he says, when I teach, at least I feel useful. I'm kind of transferring my knowledge to other people. The second reason he said for teaching is why I thought about it, is that when he teaches, he has to organize his knowledge. So he has to lay the links differently, reorganize his knowledge in order to transfer it to the students. And then students ask questions. Questions that are sometimes maybe naive, but they always bring him to think about things harder. His biggest discovery, for which he got Nobel Prize, was, I think, Feynman diagrams. The idea came, I think, in a pub somewhere where people were playing with paper plates, they were throwing them. And also, of course, from teaching, when he was teaching that to students. He gives us an example of, there was a think tank in the US after the war, top secret, because they were working on the nuclear bomb. And very, very smart people. They were given a lot of money, top secrecy. They had no contact with the outside. And he asks a rhetorical question. What came out of them? Nothing. And he blames that because they had no contact with other people, students and other people. So it's a very important thing to really talk and exchange ideas. In science, but everywhere, actually, it's a good idea. For social interactions, in politics, if you have extreme views, absolutely talk to the people who have extreme views that you don't like. Why? Maybe you will learn facts that you didn't know. Because people are listening to their own favorite media, these people too. And you need to be, of course, cultured enough to behave, not to accuse the others of being pishore and lemingi, etc., but talk about facts. You cannot dislike somebody because of his beliefs. That would be a ridiculous idea. You should exchange information, and that will hopefully bring some solution to the differences. The same in science, of course. That's why this is an important point. Talk with other people about your work. Creativity is important. There is a quote from Einstein that is very, very nice, really. Imagination is more important than knowledge, and it goes actually further, because knowledge shows you what we know, and imagination shows you the things that you don't know yet, or something, the direction where to look for them. We will talk about, I was planning to talk about creativity, what we know about it, how we can improve our own creativity. There are still a few slides that are, I should probably take the time until the end of the class. Motivation is very important. To succeed, you have to work hard. When I say 80 hours a week, I'm really repeating what I heard when I was a doctoral student. I can just confirm that, yes, if you want to achieve something of value, you have to work hard. I was probably working 80 hours a week when I was a doctoral student, because I had children when I was a doctoral student already. I would wake up early, children wake up early, I would have breakfast with them. My wife was gone already because she was working also hard at that time. So I would have breakfast with them without hurrying. Children don't like when you are hurry, when you don't have time for them. So we would just have breakfast together, talk about things. Then I would walk them to the daycare. We had it at a walking distance with my bicycle. They would go to school. I would jump on my bicycle, go to the university. I would stay there until 5 o'clock, 5:30, on my bike, pick them up from the daycare, cook. My wife would come. Sometimes she would be first. Usually I would cooking with them. Also talking and, you know, peacefully. We would have dinner together. We would watch a movie, Disney movies. I knew the dialogues by heart, you know. I could essentially watch the movie and tell you what they're going to say. And then when they went to bed around 8 o'clock, I would, again, sometimes I would go to university again. Sometimes I would work at home. And that was 6 days a week. Well, Saturday, often my wife was home, so I could go to the university earlier, come back later. I would think if you count all of it, 80 hours would be easily. Sunday, I tried, we need at least one day a week to just completely relax. And I would have one day, unless there was a deadline or something. Easily 80 hours a week. If you want to succeed, you have to do it. It sounds terrible, but you have to do it. There's research on expertise in psychology. It's called, I think, psychology of expertise. And there are certain things that are common among experts. Top sports people, like Justyna Kowalczyk, like Magda Linette, like our most famous tennis player, Iga Świątek, yes. You know, they've been working for years and very hard. It takes roughly 10 years, 80 hours a week. All successful people are workaholics. You can say, oh, Mozart was composing at the age of 6. Sure, he was. But his masterpieces came up when he was 15, 10 years later, and he was a workaholic. So you have to do it. You have to make a commitment. If you, you know, some of you are working full-time. If you can afford not to work, what I mean by that is if you can afford survive with your stipend, with your wife's husband's salary or stipend too, try to do it. You know, there's this period of time when you work hard, but you invest. If you try to do both, working and doing PhD and this, I decided myself 20-something years ago, I'm not accepting any doctoral student who is working, period, because it's a waste of time. That's my experience. Of course, you may, individual people can prove me wrong, of course, but I found it a rule. I've never had any good experiences with people who are doing this and that, and you know, unless your work allows you to do the same thing as your studies, that may happen, of course, too. Anyway, commitment. So think if you want to do it. If not, then don't waste your time and other people's time. Enthusiasm is very important because nobody has done anything of value without feeling that it's something important, great, and being enthusiastic about it. Interacting with other people, as I mentioned, is very, very important. Talk to your advisor, colleagues, people who are working in close areas, or your area, or close areas, professors in related areas. Talk to your friends and family about your work also. Of course, don't bore them. Look at their faces. If you see they are bored, stop. But, you know, if you can, you talk with them. It's also a good exercise. Caution, don't only talk, also listen, because some people just talk without listening. So make sure that you also listen and not only talk. Work on your skills. You know, like this seminar, this is really an overview of the skills. Maybe you get some ideas. Hopefully every meeting will give you one or two ideas of the many that I'm presenting. You have to learn to read quickly, several papers a day if needed. write and present your work. Find, we learn best from other people. So if you find people that are impressive, look at them, learn from them as much as you can. How they write, how they read, how they present. They're good resources. Get involved in research. Don't just wait, but right away from the very beginning. Search for your secret weapons. And do things for real, even like projects in a course, when there's a project, try to make it real, as close to reality as possible. I see some students, of course not you, but undergraduate students or something, treating a course as, well, it's a requirement, we'll do it, but kind of fiction. Try to do it, try to do things that will really advance you, your work, your research. I mentioned to you Simon, who was, I said all this already, having friends in different areas. It's a good idea in general. Being able to talk and seeing how they look at the world, that may give you ideas for research. Boundaries between disciplines. I mentioned that as Gobind reform. Again, I'm not saying about other things, but this thing, I'm absolutely convinced it was a terrible thing to do. And I'm willing to make a bet. Give it more 10 more years and it's going to be gone. At most 10 more years. Structure your time, plan your career, studies, semester, set aside time for planning. We may talk about this also in the context of time organization and stress. Having a diary helps some people. You write down what you did on a given day, or the hours that you spent. That works so that you realize that you wasted a lot of time sometimes when you write down what you did. Sometimes when you listen to somebody who is big, right, expert in your field, don't always assume that you are wrong or somebody telling something. Always use your own brain and try to reconcile what they are saying with the knowledge that you have already. Remember this fairy tale about the king is naked, right? Every child knows it, so you know it too. Don't follow the crowd. Just think yourself, because that's following the crowd is the best recipe for losing all your money, just doing wrong things. All the money in investment, of course. Research ideas, there's always a balance between revealing your ideas so that people steal them, and kind of boiling in your own sauce, which is very bad because your ideas can deteriorate, they don't get any feedback. So, of course, you shouldn't reveal your ideas by standing in the middle of a conference saying, here's my great idea, because somebody may actually pick it up. But there is nothing wrong with revealing your ideas to your colleagues here, because you can always go to them and beat them up if they get your idea, right? So, to friends, colleagues around you, it's nice. I mean, talk with them. Play with your knowledge, expose yourself to ideas. We will talk about creativity. Large chunks of time for thinking. The best time of your day, reserve it for yourself. Don't do other things, just spend on thinking. And learn all the time, all your life. We'll talk about career planning next week. I also have a lecture for you. It's a lecture by a guy, scientist, very successful scientist, Kenneth Olden. The problem with that lecture is that the recording is not great. It was recorded on a videotape years ago, and then I digitized it later, and he also doesn't speak very clearly. And I have no subtitling. So I'll send you the link on in my cloud. Try to watch it. I assure you that it's a very good lecture. The things that the guy is saying are just amazing. He's revealing all his secrets, really. That's the nice thing about it. He's telling things that people normally would not speak about. This was a lecture for young scientists like you are. And I was there also. Of course, I talked with him after the lecture. I asked later if it's okay to get a recording, to use in classes, so it's all perfectly legal. don't copy that recording and put it on Facebook or wherever. You can copy it, keep it on your disk if you want, but don't spread it, because that would be maybe a little bit of an abuse. Anyway, career planning. So you'll watch it, and we will talk about some of the things that he said. Even if you don't understand some things, I'll surely try to explain them to you. So that's next week. Expect an email from me that I have put it on the online. Any questions?